Welcome to episode 24 of Theatre Audience Podcast. I'm Natalie, and in the absence of live theatre, I'll be bringing you the news, reviews, interviews, and recommendations of the latest must-see theatre online. In episodes 21 and 22 of Theatre Audience Podcast, and on my Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram accounts, I've been discussing what's on, what's been and gone, and the best theatrical entertainment online during the lockdown. I now have a YouTube channel, which you can find by searching Theatre Audience Podcast. So it's been a difficult month for everyone. I really want my podcast now to be a space for creativity where actors can share their experiences, expertise, and skills with my drama students and my audience. As a graduate from Warwick University in theatre and performance arts, I specialised in Shakespeare and his contemporaries. As a previous actress and head of drama in a secondary school for 18 years, I want to put these podcasts out to my students, my regular listeners, and drama teachers across the country. I want this podcast to be bursting full of positivity, and to that end, I've created a Teaching Theatre in Quarantine series. I'm taking work from the page to the stage. So welcome to my Trapped Teaching Tempest podcast series. I've joined forces with a range of experienced actors from the Royal Shakespeare Company, the National Theatre, and the West End. And they are lending me their voices and skills and expertise in delivering for us some monologues and duologues from The Tempest. We will be looking at how an actor prepares for these speeches, both mentally, physically, and vocally. In The Tempest, long considered one of Shakespeare's most lyrical plays, Prospero, a magician on an enchanted island, punishes his enemies, brings happiness to his daughter, and comes to terms with the human use of supernatural power. The Tempest embodies both seemingly timeless romance and the historically specific moment in which Europe begins to explore and conquer the New World. Shakespeare wrote three main kinds of play: tragedies, comedies, and histories. The Tempest is a comedy, but that doesn't mean the whole thing is meant to be funny. Much of it is fairly light-hearted, though, and all Shakespeare's comedies have a happy ending. Most of the funny bits are the scenes with Stefano, Trinculo, and Caliban. They spend most of their time being drunk and coming up with silly schemes. These scenes might not seem side-splitting to you or me, but Shakespeare's audience would have been roaring with laughter. The Tempest is the most lyrical, profound, and fascinating of Shakespeare's late comedies, and Prospero, long exiled from Italy with his daughter Miranda, seeks to use his magical powers to defeat his former enemies. Eventually, having proved merciful, he divests himself of that magic, his art, and prepares to return to the mainland. The Tempest has often been regarded as Shakespeare's farewell to the stage before his retirement. Its complexity of thought, its range of characters from the spirit Ariel and the monster Caliban to the beautiful Miranda and her Prince Ferdinand, its poetic beauty and its exploration of difficult questions that still haunt us today make this play wonderfully compelling. And now onto the plot summary. If you know the storyline already, then feel free to skip this bit. So what happens? A terrible storm besieges a ship that carries King Alonso of Naples and members of his party. Thanks to the magical intervention of Prospero, who initiated the storm, the ship wrecks on a strange island. No loss of life, although the passengers are separated. We learn that Prospero, the Duke of Milan, years before was wrongly deprived of his throne by Antonio, his brother, acting in league with the king. Prospero was abandoned at sea with his young daughter Miranda. Eventually, the two came ashore upon the magical island, which had previously served as a banishing place for the witch Sycorax. For 12 years, Prospero and Miranda have lived here. Prospero's proficiency in magic allowed him to set free spirits, including Ariel, his servant, and the enslaved monster Caliban, Sycorax's son, who fell into disfavor with Prospero when he attempted to rape Miranda. The virtuous Gonzalo tries to comfort the king, who believes his son Ferdinand has perished in the shipwreck. The two fall asleep when Ariel casts a spell on them. Antonio and Sebastian, Alonso's brother, plot to kill the king. Ariel awakens the sleeping pair. Caliban encounters the fool, Trinculo, and the drunken butler, Stefano. They give him wine, and he vows to worship them as gods. Ferdinand, set to work by Prospero, falls in love with Miranda. Caliban, Trinculo, and Stefano drunkenly discuss a plot to kill Prospero, steal his books, and take over the island. A banquet appears and disappears. Ariel, in the form of a harpy, warns the hungry king and his companions that Ferdinand's loss is retribution for past sins. Alonso leaves, hoping to find his son's body and die where it lies. Prospero agrees to the engagement of Ferdinand to his daughter and tells Ariel to provide celebratory entertainment. The subsequent masque is interrupted when Prospero remembers the plot against his life by Caliban and his companions. He tricks them and sets spirits disguised as dogs after them. Prospero sends Ariel to collect the shaken king Antonio, Sebastian, and Gonzalo. He promises to show mercy to his past tormentors and, once his business is done, to abandon magic forever. His enemies reconcile themselves to Prospero and restore his dukedom. Alonso is reunited with his son Ferdinand. We learn that the ship has been restored to working order by the bosun. Prospero orders Ariel to supply favourable weather for the trip back to Milan, and then sets his spirit free. So welcome to part two of my Trap Teaching Tempest in Quarantine series. For the full context and themes of The Tempest, listen to episode 23, where I go into detail with Act 1 and Act 2. So I've got actors from the Royal Shakespeare Company, the National Theatre, West End, and recent drama school graduates reading monologues and duologues from The Tempest, and then providing a commentary on how they as actors prepared these speeches. I've made them refer to GCSE and A-level exam questions. So we pick up in Act 3, Scene 1, near Prospero's cave. Ferdinand enters bearing a log. Ferdinand reflects that his hard labour is pleasurable because thoughts of Miranda make the work enjoyable. Miranda pleads with him to rest. She says that the logs will weep for Ferdinand as they burn. So here is the duologue between Ferdinand and Miranda in Act 3, Scene 1.
There be some sports are painful, and their labour delight in them sets off. Some kinds of baseness are nobly undergone, and most poor matters point to rich ends. This my mean task would be as heavy to me as odious, but the mistress which I serve quickens what's dead, and makes my labour's pleasures. Oh, she is 10 times more gentle than her father's crabbed, and he's composed of harshness. I must remove some thousands of these logs and pile them up upon a sore injunction. My sweet mistress weeps when she sees me work and says such baseness had never like executor. I forget, but these sweet thoughts do even refresh my labours, most busy lest when I do it.
Alas, now, pray you, work not so hard. I would the lightning had burnt up those logs that you enjoined to pile. Pray, set it down and rest you. When this burns, 'twill weep for having wearied you. My father is hard at study. Pray now. Rest yourself. He's safe for these 3 hours.
Oh, most dear mistress, the sun will set before I discharge what I must strive to do.
If you'll sit down, I'll bear your logs the while. Pray, give me that. I'll carry it to the pile.
No, precious creature, I had rather crack my sinews, break my back, than you should such dishonour undergo while I sit lazy by.
It would become me as well as it does you, and I should do it with much more ease, for my good will is it to, and yours is against it. You look wearily.
No, noble mistress, 'tis fresh morning with me when you are by at night. I do beseech you, chiefly that I might set in my prayers. What is your name?
Miranda. Oh, my father, I have broke your hearse to say so.
Admired Miranda, indeed, the top of admiration, worth what's dearest to the world. Full, many a lady I have eyed with best regard, and many a time the harmony of their tongues hath into bondage brought my too diligent ear. For several virtues have I liked several women, never any with so fun soul. But some defect in her did quarrel with the noblest grace she owed, and put it to the foil. But you, oh, you, so perfect and so peerless, are created of every creature's best.
I do not know one of my sex, no woman's face remember, save from my glass, mine own. Nor have I seen more that I may call men than you, good friend, and my dear father. How features are abroad, I am skillless of, but by my modesty, the jewel in my dower, I would not wish any companion in the world but you. Nor can I imagine form a shape, besides yourself, to like of. But I prattle something too wildly, and my father precepts I then do forget.
I am, in my condition, a prince, Miranda. I do think a king. I would not so, and would no more endure this wooden slavery than to suffer the flesh fly blow my mouth. Hear my soul speak. The very instant that I saw you, did my heart fly to your service, there resides to make me slave to it. And for your sake, I am this patient log man.
Do you love me?
Oh, heaven, oh, earth, bear witness to this sound, and crown what I profess with kind event, if I speak true. If hollowly, invert what best is boded me to mischief. I beyond all limit of what else I in the world do love, prize, honour you.
I am a fool to weep of what I am glad of.
Wherefore weep you?
At mine unworthiness that dare not offer what I desire to give, and much less take what I shall die to want. But this is trifling, and all the more it seeks to hide itself, the bigger the bulk it shows. Hence, bashful cunning, and prompt me, plain and holy innocence. I am your wife, if you will marry me. If not, I'll die your maid. To be your fellow, you may deny me, but I'll be your servant, whether you will or no.
My mistress, dearest, and I thus humble ever.
My husband, then?
Aye. With a heart as willing as bondage, heir of freedom, here's my hand.
And mine, with my heart in it. And now farewell, till half an hour hence.
A thousand thousand.
So Ferdinand was read by Ewan Wilson, a former drama student of mine and recent graduate from Rose Bruford Drama School, and Miranda was read by Frances Knox from Royal Central School of Speech and Drama. Here's their commentary of how they created this performance in isolation together.
Hi guys, my name's Ewan. And this is...
Francis.
And we recorded Act 3, Scene 1 of The Tempest for you. So, basically, we're just going to, like, answer some questions about, like, preparing for Shakespeare. And a lot about how we kind of, like, communicate character to the audience. So, firstly, like, in terms of, like, preparing for Shakespeare, I think what's really important to remember with Shakespeare that... that I was taught anyway, I don't know about you, Francis, but is the difference between Shakespeare and a lot of contemporary text is that the thought in Shakespeare happens whilst you're saying it. So it's not like reacting whilst the other person's talking to you. A lot of it, the first time the character's thinking it is when they're saying it, which is a good rule in acting anyway, but even more heightened in Shakespeare because you can really see that thought process coming out in the soliloquies. You can really see a lot of what the characters are thinking and how their thoughts are developing and during the line. And so I think that's important to remember how we kind of communicate the characters to the audience through that kind of motivation and how your voice kind of links into how you will kind of portray that character to an audience. What do you kind of think about character?
I think, yeah, as you said, I think character is very important. And I think to understand a character, you need to know who they are, where they're from, and what they want. And I think that's, so you can get that from their voice and their movement and how they talk to other people, such as in life. And Shakespeare tends to be a kind of heightened world. So whether you're watching it or listening to it, you can take what you want out of it. But For me, what the character is wanting and what the emotion is coming from the character, that's the thing that grips me as a person when I listen or when I see Shakespeare. Yeah.
In Shakespeare as well, you have a lot of kind of like very heightened status.
Yeah, exactly.
In Shakespeare, so it's a lot of kind of...
So you can really see the classes. Yeah. And he does that deliberately, I think also because when it was written, he also likes to make like a political statement, and so he might sometimes do a very like vastly the two different, like Romeo and Juliet, two different worlds coming together, and he'll show that through the status and the voice. So I think that the characters
like move as well,
yeah, the exactly,
because a lot of the plot revolves around like Ferdinand being like a prince,
exactly,
but not here, and that, yeah, especially with The Tempest, a lot of things are like Prospero was a duke,
yeah,
but not here.
So, I like, think, in a different place. Yeah.
Noble of some kind. But not
like
here.
Ariel as, yeah, well. Like, Ariel's character is very much
like Caliban.
Based,
like, yeah, Caliban based like on the movement. Son of, yeah.
Exactly. And you can see this. Like, Caliban's one of my favourite characters. And he actually is, you know, taken from another world. And he's been, like, kind of bedraggled or kind of put into another... He's been taken like a fish out of water and put into another place. And I think The Tempest has a lot of that, is what happens if a bunch of people are somewhere that they're not meant to be and how they act. And like for Miranda, who's never even seen a woman, and the only person that she's known is Caliban and her father and, yes, this spirit. But it's up to interpretation of what Ariel is, if it's female or male. But that's a different thing. But all those things coming together, I think... that especially in The Tempest, it plays a lot with the statuses. And you can see in voice as well, quite a lot of Ariel is kind of sung and kind of the very beautiful, yeah, language, and actors tend to play with that a lot. And contrasting, so like Miranda is very fresh and kind of has an innocence to her, but also her innocence gives her a power because she hasn't seen the kind of awfulness. So the fact that she's never seen another woman, she doesn't have any of that kind of baggage, but she also has the strength of all the men around her. Mm. I think you get that from her language and also her motivation, especially in the scene we've done, as to kind of, I can do that feeling that you can see the whole way through. And I think with movement, you'll always have that on stage. It's Shakespeare's made for the outdoors. It's made for big audiences. So the characters come along, like the words come with a lot of movement. Even if you're sitting down and recording it, you'll want to move, even if the words aren't telling you
to move, if that makes sense. Yeah.
Lovely.
In Act 3, Scene 2, near Caliban's cave, Trinculo comments skeptically on his own and his companion's intelligence. Stefano promises to make Caliban his deputy. Caliban accuses Trinculo of cowardice and is mocked in return. Stefano threatens to hang Trinculo for mutiny, and Ariel begins to create trouble for Trinculo. Stefano threatens Trinculo. Caliban begs Stefano to kill Prospero. Ariel gets Trinculo into further trouble by again imitating his voice. Stefano beats Trinculo, who blames the wine for Stefano's behavior. And in the next speech, Caliban proposes a plan to kill Prospero.
Why, as I told thee, 'tis a custom with him in the afternoon to sleep. There thou mayst brain him, having first seized his books, or with a log butter his skull, or paunch him with a stake, or cut his wizened with thy knife. Remember first to possess his books, for without them he's but a sot, as I am, nor hath not one spirit to command. They all do hate him, as rootedly as I. Burn but his books. He has brave utensils, for so he calls them, which when he has a house he'll deck withal. And that most deeply to consider is the beauty of his daughter. He himself calls her a nonpareil. I never saw a woman, but only Sycorax my dam, and she, but she as far surpasseth Sycorax as greatest does least.
The part of Caliban here was read by Julian Blundell Thompson. We met at drama school, and Julian is an actor and writer. Here's his commentary of how he prepared this speech.
Hello, everybody. I've been asked by Natalie to give a few comments on my delivery of Caliban from the point of view of an actor and vocal delivery. Well, the first thing I'd say is that the inspiration for the very deep side of the voice that I used was actually from The Lord of the Rings. And there's a bit where one of the orcs says, "I'm starving! Them hobbits look tasty. Can't we go and have a look?" So that's that. That's just being honest, because I really like that. And where that comes out in the speech is where he says, "They all do hate him. As rootedly as I." So when Shakespeare gives you a word like rootedly, he means say it rootedly. It's a stage direction for the actor. So that's that. The other thing that I'd say that made me influence how I did it was that Caliban speaks in verse. And I think there's a reason for that. You'd expect him to speak in prose because he's a simple, rustic character. But I think Shakespeare gets him to speak in verse because Caliban is in a halfway point between a rustic person, almost a creature, a monster, and a human. And his journey, which he never really gets far on, is making that transition from savage to noble, from animal to human. And because he's got the capacity for human nobility, Shakespeare gets him to speak in verse. And if you look at the verse at the end of that speech, it's really, really difficult to say, which is Shakespeare's way of saying slow down. And I'm referring to, but it flows beautifully. "I never saw a woman, but only Sycorax, my dam and she, but she as far surpasseth Sycorax." See how difficult that is to say. That's Shakespeare's cue to the actor to slow down as greatest does least. See, it's really difficult to say. It's not something you'd expect to be put into the mouth of a monster that speaks like that. Anyway, there we are. I hope that's helpful. Good luck with your studies. And thank you.
Stefano agrees to do the deed. He says that he will take Miranda as his queen and will make Trinculo and Caliban his deputies. Stefano apologises for beating Trinculo. The three drunkards sing raucously, but Ariel's music strikes fear into Stefano and Trinculo. Caliban urges them not to be afraid and describes delightful sounds and wonderful dreams, and they follow Ariel's music. Here's Caliban's speech. Be not afeard. The isle is full of noises, sounds, and sweet airs that give delight and hurt not. Sometimes a thousand twangling instruments will hum about mine ears, and sometimes voices that if I then had waked after long sleep will make me sleep again. And then in dreaming, the clouds methought would open and show riches ready to drop upon me, that when I waked, I cried to dream again. So in Act 3, Scene 3, Gonzalo and Alonso are wearied by their wanderings. Alonso gives up hope of finding Ferdinand alive. Sebastian and Antonio again plot to murder Alonso. A banquet magically appears, brought in by Prospero's spirits. The courtiers wonder at what they have seen, saying it resembled something from mythology or travellers' tales. Prospero comments on the evil of Alonso, Sebastian, and Antonio, and hints at further marvels. Alonso, Sebastian, and Antonio prepare to eat, but the banquet vanishes. Disguised as a harpy, Ariel declares that he cannot be harmed. He accuses the three men of overthrowing Prospero and calls on them to repent. Here's Ariel's speech at the end of Act 3, Scene 3.
You are three men of sin, whom destiny, that hath to instrument this lower world and what is in't, the never-surfeited sea hath caused to belch up you. And on this island, where man doth not inhabit, you amongst men being most unfit to live, I have made you mad. And even with such like valour men hang and drown their proper selves. You fools! I and my fellows are ministers of fate. The elements of whom your swords are tempered may as well wound the loud winds, or with bemocked-at stabs kill the still-closing waters, as diminish one dowel that's in my plume. My fellow ministers are like invulnerable. If you could hurt, your swords are now too massy for your strengths and will not be uplifted. But remember, for that's my business to you, that you three from Milan did supplant good Prospero, exposed unto the sea, which hath requited him and his innocent child, for which foul deed the powers, delaying, not forgetting, have incensed the seas and shores, yea, all the creatures against your peace. Thee, of thy son Alonso, they have bereft, and do pronounce by me lingering perdition, worse than any death can be at once, shall step by step attend you and your ways, whose wrath's to guard you from, which here in this most desolate isle else falls upon your heads, is nothing but heart sorrow and a clear life ensuing.
Ariel was read by Rufus Wright. He's an old friend from university and a brilliant actor. I recently saw him on the Olivier stage at the National Theatre in their production of Translations. To hear our full backstage interview, have a listen to episode 6 of Theatre Audience Podcast. Here's his commentary of how he prepared this Ariel speech and a Prospero speech, which you will hear later on in this podcast.
Hi there, I am going to attempt to answer that question you asked me about how I performed those speeches. There are four things to look at: character, motivation, voice, movement, and interaction. It's difficult to say with these sorts of things. Of course, character motivation is everything. And I think what answers all four aspects of this question is that anything you do as an actor on stage, you are really trying to affect something or someone else in the story, and you're trying to affect the audience. That's a very active process, and something I learnt when I was working at the National Theatre with Ian Rickson particularly was not to play anything passive. For instance, if something really bad happens to a character,
If they simply sigh and go, oh God, how awful, and kind of crumple, that's very unsatisfying to watch as an audience member, because it's the audience's job to sigh and to crumble and to cry and to engage empathetically with what's going on. It's the character's job to actively try and change the situation or to do something about it. So I suppose that's the main lesson I would say about doing these speeches, and any speeches, is on the Prospero speech, you are three men of sin. Sorry, that's Ariel's speech. Ariel is trying to make them aware of their failings and what they've done, and how what's happening to them now is the result of that. Prospero's speech, Our Revels Are Now Ended, is a very poetic and very beautiful speech. I think it's more beautiful sounding than particularly full of character and motivation, but it's an important speech nonetheless. let me just remind myself of those categories. So voice, again, you make choices about the character's voice in rehearsal, and you try and speak the truth of the lines as clearly and as frankly as you can. And whatever voice starts to work with that, to do that job, that's the one you stick with. But it's all about truth, really, at the end of the day. Movement, again, movement is something that you will discover in rehearsal. Ariel's movement is described, I think, by other characters, rather like Puck in Midsummer Night's Dream. They're often described as being nimble or quick or fast or something. And it could be that you play the truth of that, or it could be that you play against that slightly. I saw a production of Midsummer Night's Dream at the Young Vic where my friend Lloyd Hutchinson played Puck, and he's a slightly overweight, bearded Northern Irish guy who kind of slumped around the place in a rather indolent, kind of grubby way. And it was a very funny reading of Puck. Yeah, you always have to go back to the text and see what characters say about each other, and what the characters say about how you move and how you look, and then work out what your attitude to that is. And interaction, yeah, again, as well as being active and trying to change things, your motivation is nearly always to get something from somebody else. every character in every play comes on with a series of motivations. What do they want? How are they going to get that from the other characters? And so every moment in every speech, if it's a well-written play, you can find it, and you can do what's called actioning. So you can find out what verb best describes the line of text. So any line you can take out at random and think, this is, he's persuading, he is doing something active to the other character. He's belittling, he is threatening, he's intimidating, or he's pleading, he's imploring, he's begging, he's doing something like that. So that's a good way to break down speeches. If you're not clear what's going on, sometimes it's useful to try and think of a verb which best describes whatever's going on in the scene. I hope that's helpful. Do let me know if you'd like anything else. Bye.
At the end of Act 3, Scene 3, Prospero congratulates Ariel on his performance. Alonso, remorseful, decides to drown himself. Sebastian and Antonio leave to fight the spirits. Gonzalo says all three feel guilty. He sends the younger courtiers after them. At the start of Act 4, Scene 1, near Prospero's cave, he tells Ferdinand that he has successfully endured the testing of his love and can therefore marry Miranda. Prospero warns against sex before marriage. He says it will bring misery. Ferdinand says that he will never do anything to dishonor his marriage with Miranda. Prospero sends Ariel to arrange another dramatic spectacle. Then again, warns Ferdinand against passion. Ferdinand promises that his love will overcome his lust. The mask begins. Iris describes Ceres' fertility and commands her to join Juno in celebration. Ceres asks why she must obey. Here is Iris's speech.
Ceres, most bounteous lady, thy rich lease of wheat, rye, barley, vetches, oats, and peas, thy turfy mountains where live nibbling sheep, and flat meads thatched with stover them to keep, thy banks with pioneered and twilled brims, which spongy April at thy hest betrims to make cold nymphs' chaste crowns, and thy broom groves, whose shadows the dismissed bachelor loves being last lorn, thy pole-clipped vineyard, and thy sea marge sterile and rocky hard, where thou thyself dost err. The queen of the sky, whose watery arch and messenger am I, bids thee leave these, and, with her sovereign grace, here on this grass plot, in this very place, to come and sport. Her peacocks fly amain, approach, rich Ceres, her to entertain.
The part of Iris was read by Lydia Barton Lovett. She's an actor-musician and graduates from Rose Bruford College later on this year. Here's her commentary.
My name's Lydia and I read the speech from Act 4, Scene 1 of The Tempest, playing Iris. And I'm just going to quickly talk you through what I did. So I started off by reading the speech through and I didn't understand it at all. So first off, I highlighted all the words that I didn't know what they meant, all the phrases that I didn't understand, and I looked up what they meant, a mixture of the definitions and things at the side of the text in my copy of the play, there's a Shakespeare dictionary which I have, which explains some words which only appear in Shakespeare's work, and a bit of the internet. And from that, I tried to work out what I thought the speech meant, and then I went on to the No Fear Shakespeare translation, which I think is on Spark Notes, and had a look at their modern translation of what the speech meant, and tried to see if I'd got it right. So once I worked out what I was saying, I needed to look into who was saying it. So it's a spirit from the island who is playing Iris, the goddess of the rainbow and messenger of the gods, in a mask, which is not like the mask that you put on your face. Like a mask was a very fashionable art form which would have been very familiar to Shakespeare's audience. So I did some research into magic within the context of a Jacobean audience and within the play The Tempest, and again, within the context of Jacobean audience, looked at what a mask was and what the mask within The Tempest does. Why is it there in the play? What does it symbolise? And what's important about it? So this research led me to make some choices about what I wanted to communicate to the audience through my performance. So the first thing was a sense of peace. So Iris is the goddess of the rainbow, and a rainbow appears after a storm or a tempest. So she's a symbolic of peace and harmony, which is also what Prospero plans for the wedding between Miranda and Ferdinand. They'll unite Naples and Milan, who've had years of trouble. So yeah, very symbolic of peace, and wanted to express that vocally with like a smooth quality in my voice. And similarly, if I was physicalising this character, would have a very smooth quality to all my movement. The mask is a celebration, it's full of joy, and as Iris is the first character to appear in this joyful celebration, it was important that she communicates this to the audience. So vocally, I showed this by speaking with a smile. It changes your whole throat, the shape of it, which then informs the sound. So, yeah, vocally, speaking with a smile was important. And physically, having an open body language, so palms up or out, arms not crossing the body, shoulders back, head up, would be how I would physicalise it. As it's a spirit who is delivering this speech, I wanted to make sure there was an ethereal quality to the performance. So vocally, I did this by making my voice airy, like letting more air through my vocal folds as I spoke. And if I was doing this physically, I would probably think about some of the elements. So air and water. Air is light and it floats and it's effortless, and water never stops moving. It's very fluid and it fills every space that it's given, both of which I think could contribute to feeling magical and ethereal. And finally, Iris is messenger of the gods. She's not just speaking for fun, she's got a job to do, and so she's giving instruction. And so for that, I felt it was important to include a sense of gravitas and putting some emphasis on important words. For example, the Queen of the Sky and bids thee leave these. So the when I'm talking about Juno, who is my mistress and who is very important, she has a very high status, she's Queen of the Gods. And when I'm giving the instruction, telling Ceres to leave all these beautiful places that I've been describing. Yeah, so that's my motivation, really. I've come with a job to do. I'm telling Ceres what she must do according to my mistress. So vocally, those moments where I really want to add emphasis behind words, I'd make sure that I like drop my breath into my stomach to give me more power, and use like chest resonance. So really feeling the vibrations of my voice in my chest, as opposed to like up higher in my throat or in my face. And physically, again, similar to Joy, having an open body language I think would be important, and also in this case eye contact with the person that I'm giving instructions to I think would be important.
Iris tells Ceres that they are meeting to celebrate a wedding. She assures Ceres that Venus and Cupid will not be present, and that they have failed to bewitch Ferdinand and Miranda. Juno and Ceres perform a blessing. Here's Juno's monologue.
How does my bounteous sister? Go with me to bless this twain, that they may prosperous be and honoured in their issue. Honour, riches, marriage, blessing, long continuance and increasing hourly joys be still upon you. Juno sings her blessings on you. Earth's increase, boys in plenty, barns and garners never empty. Vines and clustering bunches growing, plants with goodly burden bowing. Spring come to you at the farthest, in the very end of harvest. Scarcity and want shall shun you. Ceres' blessing so is on you.
The part of Juno was read by Bella Humphreys. She is about to graduate from Royal Central School of Speech and Drama. Here's her commentary.
So I would say when preparing to perform a character part such as Juno, what I would want to do is, right, the main thing for me is, even though she like is a character part, I still want to make them sound as real and as normal as possible. And I think that the trap a lot of people fall into with Shakespeare is by making it sound sort of weird and grand and not like normal words, whereas actually they are saying real things. So I always make sure I know the text inside out and sort of find like what is the heart of what they are saying, like what is it they're trying to communicate, so that I can really get across like the real a sort of emotional truth of what they're trying to say. I also would always make sure I warm up my voice, warm up my body, if I was performing it like on stage. Even if it's not a particularly physical role, I think always having your body physically prepared and loose and open to and just being open to the situation is, I would say, paramount to really being able to get into character and getting into a nice sort of a state where you are open to being something else. So you're not bringing your own habits into the performance. You are starting afresh and finding what habits does your character have? How do they hold their body? What is different about them to you? And how can you bring that into your performance? So that's how I would prepare for a role if I was performing it.
Prospero says that the spirits are enacting his fantasies. Ferdinand is full of happy wonder. Harvesters and nymphs dance at Iris's command, but are ordered off by Prospero when he remembers Caliban's plot. The lovers comment on Prospero's anger. Prospero tells Ferdinand not to be troubled, because everything in the mask is ephemeral and will fade. And Prospero questions Ariel about Caliban and his accomplices. Here's Prospero's speech.
Be cheerful, sir. Our revels now are ended. These, our actors, as I foretold you, were all spirits, and are melted into air, into thin air. And like the baseless fabric of this vision, the cloud-capped towers, the gorgeous palaces, the solemn temples, the great globe itself, yea, all which it inherit, shall dissolve, and like this insubstantial pageant faded, leave not a rack behind. We are such stuff as dreams are made on, and our little life is rounded with a sleep.
Prospero was read by Rufus Wright, who gave his commentary earlier on in the podcast. Ariel then describes how he led Caliban, Stefano and Trinculo into a stinking pool. Prospero plans to punish them further and reflects that Caliban is unteachable. Ariel hangs up gaudy clothes as a trap. Trinculo and Stefano complain about losing their wine, but Caliban urges them to commit the murder. The gaudy clothes attract the drunkard's interest, much to Caliban's dismay. Despite Caliban's warnings, Stefano and Trinculo are distracted by the gaudy clothes. Spirits disguised as dogs drive the conspirators away, and Prospero says his enemies are in his power. He promises Ariel his freedom. At the start of Act 5, Scene 1, Prospero foresees the success of his scheme. Ariel reports the troubled state of the king and courtiers and expresses compassion for them. Moved by Ariel's feelings, Prospero says that he too will pity them. Prospero decides on mercy rather than vengeance. He appeals to the spirits who have helped him to perform miracles and declares that he will give up his magic powers. Here's Prospero's speech.
Ye elves of hills, brooks, standing lakes, and groves, and ye that on the sands with printless foot do chase the ebbing Neptune, and do fly him when he comes back. You demi-puppets, that by moonshine do the green sour ringlets make, whereof the ewe not bites. And you, whose pastime is to make midnight mushrooms, that rejoice to hear the solemn curfew, by whose aid, weak masters though ye be, I have bedimmed the noontide sun, called forth the mutinous winds, and twixt the green sea and the azured vault set roaring war. To the dread rattling thunder have I given fire, and rifted Jove's stout oak with his own bolt. The strong-based promontory have I made shake, and by the spurs plucked up the pine and cedar. Graves at my command have waked their sleepers, oped, and let them forth by my so potent art. But this rough magic I here abjure, and when I have required some heavenly music, which even now I do, to work mine end upon their senses, that this airy charm is for, I'll break my staff, bury it certain fathoms in the earth, and deeper than did ever plummet sound, I'll drown my book.
The part of Prospero was read by Jonathan Broadbent. He's a dear friend of mine and a very accomplished actor. I recently saw him at the Sam Wanamaker Playhouse at the Globe Theatre. Johnny and I had a wonderful backstage natter about Shakespeare and his title role of Henry VI in episode 9 of the podcast. He was also in Richard III and Henry IV Part 1 and 2, and he was due to start rehearsals at the Royal Shakespeare Company for A Comedy of Errors, which I was very much looking forward to seeing him in at the Royal Shakespeare Theatre in Stratford-upon-Avon this bank holiday weekend. As we progress towards the end of the play in Act 5, Scene 1, the court party enters. Prospero praises and weeps with Gonzalo. He criticizes Alonso and Sebastian, and though recognizing Antonio's evil nature, forgives him. Prospero decides to dress as the Duke of Milan. Ariel sings about a future of everlasting summer and is sent by Prospero to fetch the sailors. Prospero presents himself to the amazed court. Alonso asks for Prospero's forgiveness and resigns all claim to Milan. Prospero embraces Gonzalo. He reminds Antonio and Sebastian that he knows of their treachery to the king, but he forgives them. Alonso regrets the loss of his son, and Prospero says he has recently lost his daughter. Alonso wishes that Ferdinand and Miranda were married and he was dead. Prospero comments on the courtiers' amazement, then reveals Ferdinand and Miranda playing chess. Ferdinand expresses gratitude to the sea. Miranda marvels at the sight of the king and courtiers. Ferdinand tells his story and Prospero urges that sorrow be forgotten. Gonzalo rejoices at the happy outcome of the voyage for everyone. Antonio blesses Ferdinand and Miranda. Gonzalo jokingly greets the boatswain, who, though dazed, announces that the ship is seaworthy and the crew is safe. Alonso is amazed by everything he sees and hears. Prospero promises to explain. He sends Ariel to fetch Caliban, Stefano, and Trinculo. They arrive. Caliban admires the courtiers. Prospero describes the drunkards and admits responsibility for Caliban. Trinculo staggers about and Stefano has severe cramps. Ordered by Prospero to behave, Caliban hopes for wisdom and forgiveness. He rejects Stefano. Prospero invites Alonso and the others to hear his story. Prospero promises a favourable voyage to Naples and sets Ariel free. Alone on stage, Prospero admits that all his magical powers have gone. He asks the audience for applause and for forgiveness to set him free. Here's Johnny Broadbent with the epilogue of Prospero.
Now my charms are all o'erthrown, and what strength I have's mine own, which is most faint. Now 'tis true, I must be here confined by you, or sent to Naples. Let me not, since I have my dukedom got, and pardoned the deceiver, dwell in this bare island by your spell, but release me from my bands with the help of your good hands. Gentle breath of yours my sails must fill, or else my project fails, which was to please. Now I want spirits to enforce, art to enchant, and my ending is despair, unless I be relieved by prayer, which pierces so that it assaults mercy itself and frees all faults. As you from crimes would pardoned be, let your indulgence set me free.
And here's Johnny Broadbent's commentary on his earlier Prospero speech and the Prospero epilogue.
Natalie, thanks for asking me to read these two speeches for you from The Tempest, which I remember you came to see me in at the Royal Shakespeare Company production at the Barbican a few years ago. I wasn't playing Prospero then, I was Antonio, the bad brother, who is pardoned in that last speech. I love these two speeches. The first one, Ye Elves of Hills, Brooks, Standing Lakes and Groves, what I love about it is a spell, but it's a spell that Prospero has with his own island, with all of the things that he has created as a magician, this habitat that he and Miranda have lived in all these years, and with Caliban and Ariel as well. And it's written in a fairly regular iambic pentameter, and I think that is normal, as with most Shakespeare, where a character goes from sort of ordinary speech into metaphorical and poetry. The poetry and the iambic heightens the sense of what it is. And also, interestingly, when you compare it back to back with the final speech of the play, which isn't written in iambic pentameter, it's often two or one beat short of the iambic. So it's a lot more like the poetry that you hear in A Midsummer Night's Dream that Puck has. And it's very similar to Puck's final speech in A Midsummer Night's Dream. If we shadows have offended, think but this and all is mended, that you have but slumbered here. And that is a spell with the audience. And in both Midsummer Night's Dream and particularly in The Tempest, Shakespeare, I think, has a relationship with the theatre itself. In the play, Prospero puts on a piece of theatre, a mask for Miranda and Ferdinand. And I think what's interesting about the epilogue, the final speech of Prospero's, is it has that same quality of Puck's. It is a spell to release the audience. By clapping your hands, you will release the spell and the magic of, you can call it a suspension of disbelief for the duration of the performance. But it's a belief that is threaded through in Shakespeare's works, that the act of hearing a play is like a spell. And I find that very moving and interesting as an idea. And it is different, as I said earlier, to the spell that Prospero has in Ye Elves of Hills and Brooks with the island. So those, in terms of my approach to these speeches, firstly, you have to recognise what the speeches are doing as an actor, and they're doing very different things. They're still both to the audience because they're both soliloquies, but there's a slightly different tonal thing going on with them. We also understand in the first speech that he is going to break his staff and drown his books. So he's going to become a mortal again, a bit like Superman does when he gives up his magic powers to be a mortal and marry Lois Lane. And he's going to do that and give those up. And that happens at the end of Act Four, I think, before the baddies basically come on and he forgives them. And so there is a sense that he is doing that without any pressure on him. It's his choice. And then the final act of the play ensues, in which Shakespeare concludes and leaves some question hanging. The main one, I suppose, being that Antonio, Prospero's brother, says nothing to him at the end of the play, and just walks off. So there is no textual evidence of any reconciliation or understanding or agreement of of what Antonio did to him in the past, which is why Prospero ended up on this island. So when you understand the context of both these speeches, they are quite simple to do. The second one is just talking to the audience, really almost as the actor, not as Prospero. He's drowned his books and he's broken his staff. It's almost like he's taking off his costume and saying, "That's it, folks." And then the first speech is a sort of reminder of his magical mysticism and his powers that then he decides to retire by the end of that speech. And I find them both moving and interesting and complex for a man who has lived with his daughter on this island for many, many years and is contemplating both the brave new world of going back to Naples and also the end of the magic of seeing a play. I hope that helps, and I hope your students all do really well in their exams. Thanks, Natalie.
So a huge thank you to all the actors who have taken part in this project. In the last episode, Jess Kambitsis, Tom Dickerson, Mark Holden and Stephen Blake. And in this episode, Ewan Wilson, Francis Knox, Julian Blundell-Thompson, Lydia Barton-Lovett, Bella Humphreys, Rufus Wright and Johnny Broadbent. Tempest Top Tips. So it's important that I credit and direct students to the following publications. I've used Shakespeare for Beginners by Brandon Toropov and the Cambridge School Shakespeare, York Notes on the Tempest and the Arden Shakespeare. All of these publications have particularly good notes on the Tempest. Also for revision and also for younger audiences, there's the BBC Shakespeare animated tales, The Tempest. And also Upstart Crow. So this was the TV comedy series created by Ben Elton and starring David Mitchell as Shakespeare. If you listen to my response to the first night preview of Upstart Crow, you can find this on episode 16 of Theatre Audience Podcast. Important historic productions of The Tempest include the 1988 National Theatre production. This was directed by Peter Hall and Prospero was played by Michael Bryant. And in 1993, the Royal Shakespeare Company in Stratford-upon-Avon had a production which was very noted, and this was directed by Sam Mendes and Prospero was played by Alex McCowan. If you go onto Digital Theatre Plus, you can see more recent productions. So 3 years ago, I saw the Royal Shakespeare Company's production, which was on at the Barbican, and this had my friend Johnny Broadbent in the show. The BBC Studios, The Tempest production is also on Digital Theatre, and Phyllida Lloyd's all-female version of The Tempest is at the Donmar Warehouse. This is also on Digital Theatre, and this was starring Harriet Walter. And now for my finale and curtain call. I'd like to dedicate Trapped Teaching Tempest in Quarantine to the following five inspirational educators. To the late Louise Bibbins, my English teacher at secondary school, who installed an understanding and unquenching thirst for the love of Shakespeare's language and imagery. To the late Jacqueline Nichols, who created the Dulwich Youth Theatre and First Rung Theatre Company, and who inspired a generation of young actors, directors, drama teachers and designers, taking us on a journey with Shakespeare from the page to the stage. To Carol Rutter, the Professor of Shakespeare and Performance Studies at Warwick University, and to the late Edward Wilson, who directed me in Othello at the National Youth Theatre, and Patrick Tucker for his Q Script workshops at Drama School with the original Shakespeare Theatre Company. Please tune in next time and recommend us to all your friends and family. Follow us on Spotify, Facebook and Instagram at Theatre Audience Podcast and on Twitter at Theatre Audi Pod. And do send us any recommendations of things you think we should see and review. If you've enjoyed the show, then please subscribe and rate us on iTunes and leave us a little review. Until next time, goodbye and thank you for listening.